and understanding. I got to have peace and love in my heart for everyone. Oh yes. Because I know some bright day I got to meet my maker. It's nobody for but mine.
Hello, and welcome back to SciSection. I'm your journalist, Amy Stewart, for the SciSection radio show, broadcasted on CFMU 93.3 FM radio station. We are here today with Dr. Dylan McKay, a nutrition and chronic disease researcher and an assistant professor of food and human nutritional sciences at the University of Manitoba. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. McKay.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
So to get us started, tell us about your educational and career background and how you got started in your field.
Sure. I guess that all starts with when I was 13 years old, I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And that kind of put me on the career trajectory that I have right now. Getting diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, everything related to food is inherently related to your health in a way. And it kind of put me on a path towards nutrition research, I think. So after high school, I went into an undergraduate program in biochemistry nutrition at Memorial University in St. John's, Newfoundland. I was thinking about medical school, but then I didn't get in my first time applying, and I got in. I decided to do a master's in biochemistry. I got into a master's program at Memorial University with just two incredible researchers, Dr. Robert Bertolo and Dr. Janet Brunton, and they're nutrition researchers, and they do research using Yucatan miniature pig models, so like animal models of nutrition. What I was looking at is the development of type 2 diabetes in this pig model and the early development, so the DOHAD, so the developmental origins of the health and disease in a piglet model. And we raised pigs and looked at the potential of developing type 2 diabetes in them for almost 13 months. And that was my master's. And I really loved the research, and I thought that the career that my supervisors had just seemed like an amazing job to supervise students, to sit on CIHR panels, review science. And it just inspired me that sort of, if I could, I want to be a researcher. And having the research in diabetes, being close to my own health, was really what I wanted to do. After that, I moved to do my PhD at the University of Manitoba. Sort of in a topic of nutrigenetics, which is the idea that personalized nutrition and how our genetic makeup may influence our response to diets, or we might be able to influence our disease risk through our diet, and that may be, mediated by our genetics. In that PhD, I started doing clinical trials. And so that's interventions with people rather than animal models. And that really sort of fit for me because I think, all of that mechanistic research eventually has to work in populations and with people in the real world. And so that's the area where I really liked to research. After my PhD, my postdoctoral fellowship was also at the University of Manitoba, and I focused on clinical nutrition interventions in all kinds of different populations. After a couple of years of postdoc, I was able to get a position at the George and Fahey Center for Healthcare Innovation, which is a patient-oriented research support center in the clinical trials platform. And that was an incredible position for me. I got to work on designing and assisting mostly clinicians, physicians and nurse practitioners, that kind of thing, psychologists, people in the healthcare system, in designing clinical trials. And they were mostly related to lifestyle. And that's that's essentially the work that I do now, and I really enjoy it. So the biggest connections I made were with some nephrology researchers and physicians, so nephrologists, doctors that treat people with chronic kidney disease. And the University of Manitoba has probably one of the best kidney disease research groups in the world, and I'm very lucky to work with them. And so we have projects ongoing right now with nutritional interventions. Really excited about one we just got funded from CIHR to look at metabolic acidosis in chronic kidney disease. And so as the kidney function begins to deteriorate in chronic kidney disease, the ability to maintain acid-base balance in the body is impacted. And some people end up with metabolic acidosis. And so metabolic acidosis is associated with worse outcomes in chronic kidney disease and faster progression. So ways to intervene to correct that acidosis are obviously of great interest. Right now, it's treated essentially by giving people capsules of baking soda orally. And that treatment's not very well tolerated by people. It's something, imagine like a volcano in your stomach. A couple times a day, you're taking these really big pills. And so the data around the world, but also in Manitoba, is that people discontinue that treatment very often. And so, you know, if someone can't continue to take a treatment, it's not a very good treatment. And there's another option potentially through diet, where if you reduce the diet's acid load or you provide bicarbonate equivalents in the diet, you might be able to sort of intervene in a different way without neutralizing the acid, just not providing it in the diet. Fortunately, fruits and vegetables are good sources of dietary bicarbonate equivalents. And there's been some preliminary trials that have shown that, you know, giving people fruits and vegetables can work almost as well or as well as a current medication that's used. And so one of the things that we're going to do now is we're going to have a feasibility trial where, you know, half of the people coming into the trial are going to get the normal pharmacological intervention, the sodium bicarbonate drugs. And the other half, we're going to deliver fruits and vegetables directly to their house. And not just enough for that one person in the house, but to all of the members of the household, because previous data suggests that if you just give it for the one person, they end up sharing it and then they don't get the dose that's needed to have the potential effect. So we're very excited about that one, and we're actually going to start that in the next couple of months.
That is some really cool research you're working on. I love how you put an emphasis on lifestyle, and it's so crazy that factors like good nutrition, something that is like has a lot to do with socioeconomical status, is something that really plays into this. I think that's really cool how it's intertwined with what you're doing too.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because in interventions and in nutrition, all of those intersecting factors are so important, right? We could come up with a perfect diet, but if people can't get it, or, you know, can't afford it, or like they can't store it, or they don't have the skills to prepare it the way it needs to be, or they can't shop for it, all of those are barriers that need to be addressed to make that intervention work, which is why I, you know, the more I've been in nutrition, the more I like the idea of like, just give the people the food as close to ready to consumption and as easy it is for them to make it.
That's really great. And I love how your story is very intertwined with your personal history too. What inspired you to pursue this career? That's very, it's very cool.
Yeah, that's 100%. Everything I eat influences my health. The other thing is that almost all of the interventions that I try to develop and work on, I like the idea of integrating them into the current healthcare system, because we have an amazing healthcare system in Canada, I think, and it needs to be supported. But a lot of research sometimes duplicates what the healthcare system already does. You know, like if we did a trial and we recruited people and we took blood samples, but they were normally getting those blood samples in the healthcare system, that data is already being paid for. And then, you know, I'd be essentially duplicating that. So there's ways to do efficient research. And it also contributes to the healthcare system, because I think the healthcare system needs to use its data to learn and improve. So the learning healthcare system and integrating nutrition research into it is sort of what I do, which I'm very happy about.
That's very cool. I want to talk a little bit more about nutrigenomics now, which you said you worked in a little bit. And that's a field that uses genetics to determine interactions between a person's genes, their nutrition and health. And you said it could be used to develop personal diet plans. Do you think nutrigenomics is the future of dieting? And how much do you think we can rely on our genetics for what we should and shouldn't be eating?
So I may have just hinted at it. It's sort of been an evolution of my research career. I started my PhD like really deep in nutrigenetics and the idea, you know, that maybe the right diet for somebody is dictated by their genes. And we just published a trial in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition called Gene Predict, where we actually did a clinical trial where we picked some genes in advance that we thought were going to influence response to an intervention. And you know, based on previous trials, they've been associated with response. But when we did a trial where we genotyped in advance and then intervened in sort of a better, I would say, methodological way, we showed that unfortunately or fortunately for this set of genes, it didn't show any difference in the response. As I advanced through my PhD, you know, the more and more and through my postdoctoral work and subsequent jobs, I've seen that there's so many other factors outside of genetics that we just discussed that I think have a much larger influence on people's health. Genetics may explain some things, but you know, even if you had certain genes that told you about an optimal diet, how you access and get that optimal diet is far more likely to be influenced by your education, your neighborhood, where you were born, all kinds of other factors. You know, you can't change your genetics, and most of those other factors are hard to change as well. I'm leaning less and less towards seeing that, you know, personalizing based on genetics is going to be a way forward. One of the big things that I see with that also is that it internalizes the health, you know, like potential health problems or the responsibility for your health outcomes based on your genetics. And in general, I just don't think that's a positive way to look at it, right? Our health is influenced by so many factors that I don't think individuals have the potential to change. And the idea of testing someone and giving them the diet, it just doubles down on that, right? So like, you know, if you have something like type 2 diabetes and, oh, it was because you had the genes, it may not be because of, you know, the food desert that you grew up in or the fact that, you know, you never learned all of the skills or have had access to the resources to create a healthier diet for yourself. And those are not things that people can necessarily choose or change. I think they take like society and community-based changes. And I think that's where the most impact comes from. So I would say, you know, nutrigenomics is not the future of selecting healthy diets. It's something that, you know, I started my PhD and thinking that this could be incredible. And then by the end and now it's completely opposite. So, you know, I have to be open to new evidence. And that's really been an evolution of my career.
And that is really cool. And I'd have to say, I agree with the point you make. If people learn that the way they are and how they eat and their nutrition is because of their genetics, they're going to feel like it's a lot harder to change that. And I don't think that's a narrative you want to be sharing when it's concerning people's eating habits.
The other thing is I just don't see the effect size there too. So when you look at the impact of, you know, genetic variations, if we were finding, if, you know, other than things like, say, like phenylketonuria or something like that, where it's like a rare disease that's caused by a well-characterized variation in the genetics that has a huge impact, I think we know all of those basically, because there's such huge changes to the phenotype or the outcomes that they're easy to find. But the genetics of common complex diseases like heart disease and diabetes, the influence of diet interacting with genetics, very, very small relative to other things that we know that have a larger impact on those diseases, right? So when something has a very, very small influence and it's interacting with numerous variations, right? You could have, like, let's say you had 5 variations that put you at a greater risk of diabetes. You could have 20 that put you at less. How do you calculate that? And it becomes very complex. And it's not something I think that science is at the level to handle at the moment, maybe in the future. But then even if we can design the perfect diet based on the genetics, implementing that is going to still have all of the other barriers that we know exist to getting a healthy diet.
And with your career in nutrition, which has a lot to do with weight loss, I'm sure you see a lot of misinformation in your field and on the internet. And I know you're really big on combating that misinformation. So what do you think the scientific community could do to ensure that research is being heard by the people who need it and that it's being communicated effectively?
It's about approachability, I think, and humanizing the researchers that are there. And I know it's not for everybody in science, but, you know, being available and honest and transparent is really key on these things, because every time that you aren't, there's so much potential for that stuff to be used for disinformation or to be used to discount So some of my research has funding from governments, other projects that have research from industry, and it has to be very transparent about that. I'm very active on Twitter and approachable, increasingly more political, I guess. Being apolitical is just is not something I think scientists can morally be right now, because that in itself is a stance. But, fostering trust has to be about being transparent and approachable in the translating our research. So, podcasts, social media, everything that can get the message out there and see that, the people who work in science and who generate this are real humans with the same lives and issues that everybody else is. It's a job. That being said, it is a huge, huge problem to combat misinformation. And you see that a lot of the misinformation overlaps incredibly. And there are political forces that are, fighting in misinformation. And then there's also financial things that push misinformation, especially in nutrition and dieting and like weight loss, right? Where the message comes from, I always think is like, who does this message benefit financially? Because, in many things in our society, it's benefiting somebody, and that's why they're putting it out there. And that's an important first step. Money can buy a lot of directed misinformation to keep people going to their products.
It definitely is a very dangerous cycle. I mean, we've seen it with climate change. We've seen it with COVID. It's very important that people get their information from experts that aren't influenced by factors such as like politics and financing and all that. But it's definitely a messy, messy field. That's all the time we have for today. Yep. So thank you so much for joining us, Dr. McKay. It was fascinating to hear about your research in nutrition and chronic diseases. And I'm very excited to see what your research has in store.
Oh my, I can't wait to see what it's going to turn out. So it's what I do. Thank you for having me.
Thank you again.
Welcome to SciSection. My name is Raj. We are here today with Dr. Baljeet Singh. Thanks for taking your time to meet with me, Dr. Singh.
Raj, thank you very much for this opportunity, and I'm very pleased to be speaking with you. Thank you very much.
And to begin, so we know that you're the dean at a veterinary school in Calgary.
Yes, I am. I was appointed as the dean in 2016, so this is my fifth year in this role.
Okay, and what sparked your interest in veterinary science?
I grew up in Punjab, India, in a village, and in a very typical agricultural family. And the education is one of the ways families grow and they progress. So I was thinking about going to the medical school in Punjab. In India, typically medical school seems like the first priority for most of the kids who may be doing well in their academics. Veterinary school was my number two in the priority list. I could not make it into the medical school, but going to the veterinary school also represented a major step up for me within my family, because my mother really did not have any opportunity to go to school, and my father was a high school teacher. So going to a professional medical science program, whether veterinary or human, was a major accomplishment. So I was very happy to be in a veterinary program.
Well, that's great. And so coming from India to Canada to continue your education, what were some of the highlights and maybe some obstacles that you faced when you first arrived?
Coming to University of Guelph and getting admitted into a graduate program was an absolutely amazing opportunity. And I was on a travel tourist visa to Canada at that point, and it was just a sheer coincidence that I ended up meeting with Professor Onkar Atwal, who was at Ontario Veterinary College, and he offered me admission into his research program. So I stayed. Guelph, I'm not sure whether you can imagine it, 30 years ago, it was less than 100,000 population, and the city has not crept that much towards 401. It was called a sleepy cow town. And because of the basic foundation of agriculture and veterinary programs at University of Guelph. To me, it was being a kid in a candy store. It was before the cell phones, internet, and everything. So coming to be in Canada at a university, pursuing the graduate program was the highlight. through that excitement, I don't recall many challenges. I became involved with the student government. I was elected as vice president of Graduate Student Association. I served on the Senate. I participated in community events such as the annual Speed River Cleanup, which takes place in May or June. I became very much part of the student fabric at University of Guelph. And those friendships and relationships at OVC resulting in teaching awards as a graduate student, I'm sure there must be my name still in the Central Student Association office as the Excellence in Teaching Award winner in 93, I believe, and community work, and it just was fantastic. Challenges, yes, English as the third language, learning to write well, speak well, and also learning about the social customs in Guelph or in Canada. Those could be daunting challenges for anybody as you travel from one place to another. But outstanding friendships made at Guelph were just amazing. And I had a great time. And great mentors like former president of University of Guelph, Dr. Alastair Summerly, became one of the closest mentors and friends who showed me the way within the academic system in Canada. And I attribute a great deal of my success to him.
That's great. And just a little follow-up, you said English is your third language.
Right, because in India, the Punjabi is my first language. Then in India, there is the system, Hindi becomes your second language. Mm-hmm. So I began to study in the English medium only after high school. So my undergraduate veterinary program, of course, we used English textbooks. But still, when you're talking to your professors, most of the time, we will speak in Punjabi. So coming to Canada was a major opportunity to brush up on that and really grow my abilities to communicate well in this language.
That's amazing that you can speak three languages though. And so every student faces different challenges. They have their own obstacles and how they gain experience. And you've gained a lot of experience going from Punjab and then coming to Canada. Mm-hmm. And so what would your advice be to students that want to pursue some graduate school studies, whether it be vet school, medical, mm-hmm. dental, anything?
Education is one vehicle that makes us better citizens, makes us better, allows us to better our lives, and that we do through our abilities to think about complex topics and also an ability to deal with conflicts in a peaceful and a rational manner. So those are the tools that education gives us. Degrees are just part of the process that we get. So, and another major benefit of being a student is that you get forgiven for all the mistakes that you make, many of the mistakes, because you are young, people are learning. So I believe that I will not be forgiven for something if I do now as a dean, and with the same thing I could be forgiven if I was a student. So I think taking full advantage of exploring friendships, relationships, new ideas, new sciences, going to seminars, going to concerts, being part of the community groups, and participating in variety of things to really expose ourselves to as many different ways of thinking and learning as possible would be my advice and a suggestion to anyone. Throw yourself headlong into the experience of humanity when we are students, whether undergraduate or graduate. And so that is the one thing which I believe in and enjoy.
Yeah, for sure. As I'm a student, and I can definitely agree to that, that the more you go out and put yourself out, life also becomes much more fun. And you see if you'll actually enjoy going into that field or not.
Right.
And so now, with the recent COVID outbreak going on, everything's changed so much. And there's so many questions that come into the media about animal meat consumption. And, you know, coming with COVID and people thinking that it came from an animal or anything like that. And so people are beginning to contemplate whether they should stop eating meat in order to be less susceptible to diseases and outbreaks like these. And what are your thoughts on that?
The first and foremost thought is that this debate around COVID, where it comes from, what type of disease it causes, whether we should eat meat or not, this again simply is the desire of the society to ask for more science, more science-based policy, more science-based debate and discussion to make a consensus or a decision, whether at the individual level or at the level of a group. So When we ask a question of this nature, we are all saying, do we have the scientific evidence to make that decision one way or the other? Mm-hmm. The second question, I'm a vegetarian. I lead a faculty in a province which has 1/3 of the beef cows that of the whole of Canada. Mm-hmm. So I believe in individual freedom, individual choice as to what people like to do with their decisions, as long as their decision does not harm the community at a broader level.
Okay.
We are in this enthrall of synthetic meat. But if you really think about the way we produce synthetic meat, there are so many questions to which we don't even have answers yet. What does it mean to grow something in a petri dish? And when we consume it, where does it go in the body? Does it have a negative effect on the intestine or the stomach? Can it produce cancer in the body? We don't know these things. So we need to do a lot more research on the synthetic meat. I think we know a lot more about the animal meat. It is good and the bad. And people still have a lot more science to make a decision whether they would like to consume beef or pork or chicken or eggs or the milk which we derive from the animals. I wrote an op-ed last year because I believe we are getting very polarized in these discussions. We need to be science-driven when we talk about these issues so that we do not become antagonistic to each other, we do not become angry at each other, so that we can have a thoughtful, scientific discussion on these topics. So again, it's an individual choice. There's quite a bit of science. We need more science, and that will continue to come out of the science programs at Canadian and other universities in the world.
Mm-hmm. And do you think this also applies to things like milk alternatives? So now we've spoken about meats, but like in terms of milk, because, you know, there's cow milk, but then people can be lactose intolerant, and then they go for alternatives where it could be almond milk, cashew milk, coconut milk, anything. And do you think there's a fairly good amount of research on there? Or do you think that that still is underway before we can make a conclusion? Because some people may believe that the protein might not be as good in those alternative milks, or because some nutrients aren't naturally produced, or they're just additives. So what are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are, the moment we say alternative, it means that we are trying to find something to replace our product or something we use based on variety of considerations. They could be philosophical, medical, scientific, and so forth. And no single food product is complete. And we always need to have balanced diet, whether we drink almond milk or soya milk or the natural milk from the cow. These alternatives, which are, again, if you take something from a natural plant-based, that is one thing. If you are synthesizing milk in a test tube, that again is going to call for a lot more questions, regulations, studies on animal models, and then long-term studies on humans. One of the challenges with anything that we consume as human beings, that it takes a long time to gather data. Hundreds of thousands of people will have to consume it over a number of years before we begin to see some positive or negative health effects. Mm-hmm. So I think these questions always require a great degree of patience, which sometimes we do not demonstrate. As to how to do that. Another piece is the unintended consequences. When we began to mix gas with ethanol to make it better or reduce the consumption of the gas, large agriculture lands in Brazil and other places began to grow corn from which ethanol is produced. What did that do to other crops which the people were producing? Because ethanol or the corn became a cash crop. That led to the displacement of cereals or other crops which people were growing for their food. So I think these are all connected systems, not only within a country, but globally now. We saw the spread of COVID from China to other places and how it led to the shutdown of the global economic system. Again, we need to be thinking, working as groups. You as a biomedical student sitting next to a policy, social science graduate student, mm-hmm. would create a better essay written at the end of the day than if you were to do purely based on your biomedical science textbook. So that piece of collaboration with a young generation like yours is much more nimble compared to people like me, because we grew in a pre-cell phone internet era in some ways. So I have great hope from the students such as yourself, and I see nothing but positive things happening in the next decades as this new generation takes over from people who are currently doing science and teaching and policy.
For sure. That's great. And so lastly, to end on, we know that your son, Paul, is into playing the tabla, which is a pair of Indian hand drums. And is there any instruments or hidden talents that you may have that we may not know of?
I really don't have any special talents. I call myself an extraordinarily ordinary individual. Mm-hmm. So I have been able to do a few things in my life because I am always in a group. I work in a collaborative way, and I like to work with lots of very bright and creative.